This is Place Matters, a podcast at the intersection of race, place, and poverty, where we explore the belief that the path towards ending inequity and promoting prosperity is through the work of holistic neighborhood development. Welcome to Season 6, Voices from the Field, where we speak with historians, researchers, authors, and thought leaders whose work is shaping the field of place-based development. I'm Sean Duncan, the Director of Training and Consulting at Focused Community Strategies and the host for Place Matters. As more and more people are moving back into cities, we are seeing a boom in residential and commercial development, as well as growth in civic and public investments in services and infrastructure. Some see this as good news, a time of urban revival, economic growth, and expanded opportunity. Others see this as a threat to the identity of historic neighborhoods and the stability of legacy residents. The former sees this as a sign of prosperity, the latter as a sign of gentrification. Both, unfortunately, are products of oversimplified narratives about either progress or injustice. What we're dealing with is not just urban growth, we are talking about neighborhood change. And for the sake of our neighborhoods, we need to develop a more robust understanding of the changes we are facing so that we can more accurately identify the real threats and the true opportunities for creating more equitable communities. Joining me today to talk about neighborhood change is an urbanist, author, and scholar, Alan Malik. Alan is a senior fellow at the Center for Community Progress in Washington, D.C., and has worked with, among others, the Brookings Institution, the Federal Reserve, and Rutgers University. He is a leading voice in how poverty and prosperity are connected to the places in which we live. Listen in as we discuss his most recent book, The Changing American Neighborhood, which explores the role of neighborhoods in American society and the challenges they are facing today. Well, thank you so much for making time to be a part of this conversation with Place Matters today. I have to say that your scholarship and your work has really benefited me and has been so clarifying as a person who works in place-based environments, as well as the team that I lead. We're currently reading through The Changing American Neighborhood. It's been extremely enlightening to our team, and we've really loved working through that. So thank you for your work, and thank you for making time to be a part of this today.
Well, certainly. Thank you for saying those wonderful things about my work, and I'm delighted to be here.
Awesome. Well, before we get into the great scholarship and a lot of the good stuff that you've been working on, I'm curious first, why does this matter to you personally? Like, I don't imagine this scholarship or this route of study was just a random choice. Like, what in your life made you want to give your professional and research interest to cities, to neighborhoods?
Actually, I think it goes back to a long time ago when I was a student in college and the civil rights movement was happening. And that's what really energized me. And I became, as best I could, part of that. I was very active in CORE, which is an organization I think most younger people probably have never heard of. But it was a major force back in the 60s and worked in Mississippi on a couple of occasions. And this just, I guess at that point, I decided that whatever I wanted to do with my life, it had to do with fostering social justice. And then the question, of course, came, what? That's certainly an awfully broad sphere.
Yeah.
And I found two things. One that I have been fascinated by and intrigued by, the physical environment that people share. Yeah. And how it works, and how it works for people, against people, how it creates inequality or can create opportunity, and so forth. And the second thing I realized fairly early in my life, that I was not cut out for what you might call retail. I mean, in terms of just sort of day-to-day encounters, social services, that kind of thing, that my head, my temperament was elsewhere. So I think I gravitated towards planning as a discipline, which I could use to further my commitment. And sort of going beyond that, looking at cities, neighborhoods, how people live together. And it's something that you can never stop learning about, because for one thing, it's constantly changing.
Yeah.
And I think it's incredibly important that we understand how our physical environment and our social environment tie together and either work or do work with each other.
Wow. Yeah. Well, I'm with you. I feel like it is it's not a field of study where you're going to be like, all right, well, we've reached the bottom of that discovery. I feel like, I haven't been at this nearly as long as you have, but I feel like, even just the last decade being on this team, I still feel like I'm enrolling in my freshman year. Like there's just so much to like learn and observe, and even like, what category would you even put neighborhood in if it were like an official degree that you're now a professor of neighborhoods, right? It touches every category, right? It's just so broad and so fascinating.
And that's one of the important things about studying neighborhoods and understanding neighborhoods. You can't look at it through a narrow lens. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you can't say, okay, I'm an economist, I'm going to look at neighborhoods as economic entities. Yes, they are economic entities. But if you just look at it through that lens, you get it wrong.
Yeah.
And the same is true if you're looking at it just as a designer or a planner, or looking at just the physical, what are we going to do with the zoning and the buildings? Again, yes, that's part of it. But if you just do that, you're, again, getting it wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love, I think one of the most helpful kind of metaphorical pieces that emerged as I was reading through your book was the, like how you were saying, you know, neighborhoods are not like mechanical entities. You can't just like add the right parts and assume it's going to work and be healthy. But they're like on the other side of that, they're biological or ecological at some level. That there's no proven answer that's always going to work because it's some sort of machine that just needs a missing part in some way.
Exactly. I think the ecological parallel is very real. A neighborhood is an ecology, just like a natural system with an awful lot of different things going on and interacting with each other and constantly creating feedback for each other. Makes it complicated. But if you don't understand that, you can't understand what's going on in a neighborhood, and equally important, you're not likely to be effective in changing it in the direction that the neighbor wants to go.
Yes. And I think what I appreciate is like just in sheer fact of you advocating for neighborhood, right? I think neighborhood's a word that still is used. It means almost something different every time I hear someone using it. But like you're advocating still for neighborhood, right? And I think in a digital age, in an interstate age, in an internet age, like place and like hyper localized place seems like an odd thing to advocate for. Like, why would you say neighborhoods, that highly localized ecosystem, like why does that still matter even today?
That's a good question, because you know, so many people seem to think they live online, they live on Facebook, they live on Twitter, and or X, I guess. But people actually live, despite all the technology, through face-to-face relationships. And one of the really interesting things about how human beings work, we have different types of relationships, different types of ties. Mm-hmm. And there's a concept known as weak ties.
Yeah.
And another term for it is sometimes called bridging ties, bonding and bridging ties. Because we have our close relationships with our family, with our closest friends, with the people we live with, the people we see constantly, and so forth. And the interesting thing about that, those relationships are incredibly important, but those relationships kind of form like a sealed chamber. The weak ties or the bridging ties are the other more casual relationships that happen in our lives outside that sort of closed circle of family and friends. And the thing is, those are incredibly important. That's how we relate to the larger world. And number two, the most important place where those happen is where you live, your neighborhood. And in fact, it's the connection between you and the neighbor whom you occasionally talk to, the person across the street who looks, keeps an eye on your house when you're on vacation, the block club, or the neighborhood organization, or the neighborhood cleanup, or in fact, if you go to a coffee place, the fact that you go there every day and the barista recognizes you and says the usual. And this is a whole network of things. And these are the relationships that people have that enable them to connect with the rest of the world. And that the less you have, the more you're likely to get into that kind of echo chamber of the internet, the political life, and so forth. So neighborhoods are where those bridging ties happen, the, where the weak ties are most alive. And if you lose that, you lose a great deal about what is essentially the glue in our society. And I don't think people appreciate that enough, that if, that a lot of the polarization and fragmentation that we're seeing in today's America has to do with the fact that we are losing those ties and we are becoming sort of caught up in our own little worlds with people who agree with us, people who are our friends. We don't have those connections. And that's why neighborhoods are incredibly important. And if anything, more than ever.
Yeah. I think about like various things are kind of colliding in my mind as you're describing the kind of the strength of weak ties, right? Like how much stronger our societies are with these public relationships. And I think about like all the research lately of like the diseases and deaths of despair, like heightened loneliness, or just the fracturing of American public discourse, or some of that recent research on the sorting of neighborhoods and how we're kind of even when we're offline and in place, we're in echo chambers. And like really, this is not about just like some idyllic nostalgic notion of like the happy little neighborhood. It's like, no, this is about whether our society will be fragile or not. What like and that local neighborhood level is where we can reframe a strong fabric of culture again, that it becomes much more significant than just like, hey, do you chat with your neighbor or not? Like that may seem small, but there's societal weight, you know, going on
it's
here.
It's incredibly important. Let me read. I did a webinar on some of these issues for an organization, in fact, just yesterday, and with my co-author, Todd Swanstrom. And afterwards, I got an email from one of the people who listened. This is a guy I happen to know. He's a community activist in Detroit, in a neighborhood in Detroit. I'd just like to read this email.
Oh, please. Yeah.
It just, he says, I think the environment of weak ties increases the chances stronger relationships can develop. Some examples. On my block, we have an annual block party. This may be the only time in the year that I talk with a neighbor down the block, but we still know each other by name. On the other hand, we've become close friends with a neighbor two doors down. Another example. Our neighborhood organizes soccer and Little League for kids. Through these programs, I made hundreds of acquaintances and a few strong, lasting friendships. My wife organizes a monthly neighborhood cleanup called the Fun Litter Pickup Club. They emphasize having fun together at least as much as picking up litter. I marvel at how many friendships have developed from this activity. The deeper relationships are important for increasing stickiness in the neighborhood.
Yeah, and I love that.
That's amazing. This is amazing. And this is what goes on. Can go on.
Yeah. I mean, I think about like at a deep, deep level, the most fundamental thing we need is belonging. Right. I mean, of course, there's, you know, shelter, food, water, whatever. In the sense of like, you know, 20 years into the social media experiment, like if we're really honest about it, I think we feel less belonging. Like I have so many more friends, followers, connections than I ever had prior to social media. But it has not increased my sense of belonging. It feels more isolating than ever.
Right? And, you know, my own experience, again, I live in a village of about 800 people. Now, I don't know all 800, even by sight. I mean, people come, they go, and so forth. But I know a lot of them. And a lot of people, we go for walks and we meet at the post office because you got to pick up your mail. They don't deliver it to the home and so forth. Mm-hmm. And you see somebody, you see somebody, even if you don't know who they are, you say hi. Mm. If they have a dog, you stop and pet them. You know them even a little bit. Maybe you stop for a couple minutes just to chat.
Yeah.
This, you're constantly interacting with each other and you constantly have this sense that you're in a, again, a web of belonging. Mm-hmm. And again, this is something that just having strong family connections, which is incredibly important too. Mm-hmm. It's not like it's one or the other.
Right.
It's both. And they reinforce mm-hmm. each other.
Yeah.
As the email from my friend mm-hmm. indicates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My notions on immigration have been more affected by neighbors across the street or kids in my own children's classroom and their families, that it was really easy to have certain like non-contextualized ideas or beliefs about what we should or should not do around immigration reform until like there's people with names. There's homes I've been invited into, you know, there's children that I've been able to volunteer and sit and read with at the local school. Like our whole posture of social interaction changes when it's, yeah. when there's this, well, and you use the word neighboring, which I love because like it's actually one of our organization's three core values is neighboring. It's the first one on the list. And so don't see the word neighbor with ING that often. So I was like, hey, look, were you, this is being used. So like, why would you like, when we think about neighborhood change, there's so many structural systemic pot, there's so many huge things we would be thinking about, but like, and we do, and you do address those things, your book, of course, but like, you also come down to say like, hey, neighboring is really as crucial as anything to all of this. Like, what is neighboring in your language, and why would you advocate that this is such an important part of how neighborhoods change and become healthy?
Yeah. Neighboring is basically the way the weak ties manifest themselves. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's the fact that, you know, I'm out there shoveling snow and in fact, it's not even the neighbor across the street. It's the son of the neighbor across the street who came to help her deal with her snow. And he's got a snowblower. So he comes over and say, hey, can I help you? It looks like your things aren't going that well. And next thing you know, my driveway is clear. Mm-hmm. It's all those things. It's the saying hello. It's the block clubs and the litter pickups. And so it's the sum of the actions that support and reinforce the weak ties and that enable people to make connections with people who aren't necessarily like them. Like you would make connections with an immigrant family, say from Somalia or wherever. And it's that enables us to start understanding our shared humanity, rather than getting into those ideological and political and religious and cultural echo chambers where all we know are the people who agree with us or who are like us.
Yeah, I love that. And for us, like, and so we're a, you know, place-based neighbor development organization. Like we are working in the neighborhoods that have experienced decline for decades, that are places of concentrated disadvantage. Like that's the world that we live in as practitioners, but we also have like a consulting team that works with other people who are in very similar types of neighborhoods. And so like this idea of neighborhood change, that's what we swim in every day, all day. And it's crucial that we think about massive systemic and structural barriers to well-being. But I love that. But for us, so development is one of our core values, but our first one's neighboring. Like the development only matters in as much as it's deeply about people and relationships. It's not just about bricks and sticks or policies, which matter. It really is about this human ecology, right, that's at play in neighborhoods.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's talk a little bit about neighborhood change. One of the things that you emphasize in talking about neighborhood change, you make it clear kind of up front, this principle that, hey, neighborhoods are always changing, period, right? Why is that an important disclaimer or thing to kind of state up front? If we're going to talk about neighborhood change, first and foremost, they're always changing anyway. Why does that matter as an upfront kind of statement?
I think one reason is that I think an awful lot of people seem to believe that you can freeze a neighborhood in a particular point of time and a particular mm-hmm. type of neighborhood. This particularly in the whole discussion of gentrification, for example, which maybe mm-hmm. we'll get to, mm-hmm. is the underlying notion that somehow if we can prevent this area from gentrifying, we can mm-hmm. stabilize this neighborhood the way it has been, the way we want it to be, the way it always is. That's mm-hmm. not true. Mm-hmm. Neighborhoods change. Now, maybe some at the edges don't. I think mm-hmm. you could make a case that the strongest, most affluent neighborhoods may not change. Mm-hmm. And the weakest, most distressed, disinvested neighborhoods may not change, because essentially, barring some major transformation, they're kind of stuck. Mm. But everything in between is constantly changing. And you think about the neighborhoods that we live in. You look back 20 years, 30 years, some neighborhoods go down economically or socially in the sense of becoming more fragmented and less cohesive. Mm-hmm. Other neighborhoods go up in the same. Other neighborhoods may stay very similar in their economic level, but may change demographically, racially, mm-hmm. ethnically mm-hmm. over time. So the main thing is there is a constant process of change. Mm-hmm. And you have to recognize that, mm-hmm. because if you think you can keep a neighborhood frozen at a particular yeah. place, you're wrong.
Yeah, yeah. And I feel like that message comes out of like, it's more than two, but for the sake of simplicity, that like there's kind of these broad camps of like, there's like the nostalgia camp that's like, yeah. like kind of wishing back for some magical era of these homogeneous kind of perfect little neighborhoods, which didn't ever really exist anyway. Then there's the others of like, from different motives of saying like, hey, we've got to protect and preserve this historic neighborhood and not let it change or gentrify or whatever, because like, again, because it's envisioning some sort of static thing that's always been and somehow will always be, and versus like, no, it's been dynamically evolving since beginning, right?
And like, I mean, the neighborhood nostalgia is a very powerful tendency. Mm-hmm. And an awful lot of people think about how a particular neighborhood was back in the 50s or even in the 20s or 30s. Sometimes mm-hmm. it goes way back. Mm-hmm. But that was a different world. It was a different mm-hmm. dynamic. And also, of course, people tend to romanticize those.
Yeah, yeah.
People think about the kind of cohesion you had, for example, in the old black neighborhoods when people mm-hmm. were, you had segregation and people were forced into, mm-hmm. What were rightly known as ghettos, because mm-hmm. they were forced into them. Mm-hmm. And you had this amazing variety and diversity of people economically, socially, mm-hmm. culturally, what have you, all within the same place. And it was, in some respects, wonderful.
Yeah.
It was also crowded, poor, housing conditions were horrible. Mm-hmm. And opportunities were incredibly few. Mm-hmm. And so as soon as things changed, that neighborhood, that type of neighborhood fell apart, not because of anybody's decision that was a bad thing or anything, but that people wanted something else. People who had money wanted the opportunity to buy a nice house in a nice green neighborhood, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So things are constantly changing because mm-hmm. the world is constantly changing, and neighborhoods are, after all, a reflection of the world.
Hey guys, just wanted to take a quick break from this conversation to make an invitation. If you are feeling challenged by these conversations and are wondering how to address these realities in your own neighborhood, please reach out to us. Place-based work is too hard to go at it alone. So whether it's some one-on-one coaching or us walking with you through our two-year cohort called City Shapers, we're here for you. Please reach out to us today at fcsministries.org.
And I think, so like being in the business of neighborhood change, you know, we're in conversations constantly with people who are, I would say, in agreement on the challenges in front of us, in agreement on a more equitable future where black and brown neighborhoods, especially those of concentrated poverty, can be places of opportunity and access and thriving and belonging. But maybe where I see a parting of ways, and it's not real overt, it's almost like a type of thinking under the surface of that's these assumptions of how neighborhoods are going to change or the kind of change that we need to be advocating for. That's where I feel like there's a departing of ways of when we start thinking about what this entity called a neighborhood, how it's going to experience change in a healthy way towards these ideals that we have. So from your experience, how can we better understand this idea of neighborhood change and doing it in ways that are healthy, right?
Okay, first, we got to step back from the idea that there's a magic bullet or that things you can do X and, you know, Y will logically follow because it's a good thing, and start to look at what is driving neighborhood change. Okay, the first thing is, you know, you have a lot of external forces going on, which impact on a neighborhood. But the key thing is, and I've got a great graph that shows this in the book, is when a neighborhood is affected by something, it's not a simple linear, the neighborhood changes. Neighborhoods are multiple actors. You have at least four different categories of actor affects how neighborhoods change. And I think residents, and that's not even a single group, too, because there are lots of different types of people with different attitudes, different perceptions of the neighborhood and so forth living within any neighborhood. But you've got residents, you've got government, which affects neighborhoods in all kinds of ways. You've got a variety of institutions ranging from employers, banks, etc. And then, of course, you have the larger regional housing market, which is either responding to the neighborhood or not, or in different ways. And now here's the thing. So you have all of these different players there. Now, the key thing that you got to understand is when you get a stimulus, something happens. People's behavior doesn't change directly as a result. First, it affects people's perceptions.
Yeah.
And it's their perception of what's happening is what affects behavior. I mean, that's critical to understand. I remember, well, one story, and there was in a struggling working class neighborhood in Boston, there was a nonprofit that was trying to rehab a bunch of badly run down, dilapidated properties, and who assumed that the people in the neighborhood would be appreciative and happy and respond positively. And instead, what they discovered is that there was tremendous opposition to what they were doing. How could you be opposed to fixing up these horrible buildings? Well, again, this was a neighborhood that was, as I said, it was struggling. It was a working class neighborhood. It was very felt. There was a lot of insecurity about the future of the neighborhood going to be, which again, the nonprofit didn't appreciate that. And somehow word had gotten around in the neighborhood that this was going to be, quote, Section 8 housing.
Oh, wow. Okay, yeah.
And so in the context of the insecurity that people felt about their neighborhood's trajectory, that to them was like, this is a slap in the face of the community. So, hence, hostility.
Yeah.
So it's not about that's the thing. A lot of people who work in community development think that if they do something physically, they build a housing project, they restore a park, they build a shopping center, whatever, that they do these concrete things, that that's going to change neighborhood. No.
Yeah.
It's not. It's how those things affect people's perception of the neighborhood and whether they do. Now, I think one thing that I think is, a lot of cases, people who've built, for example, tax credit projects in deeply distressed neighborhoods, I mean, that's probably a good thing in that you now have X number of families who have higher quality housing than they previously did. But it doesn't necessarily improve the neighborhood. It doesn't necessarily increase neighborhood or make people feel more positive about the neighborhood.
Right.
Maybe just a bump. So the key thing is to understand, first, there are lots of different actors affecting what happens in a neighborhood. Second, it's how they perceive the change that is going to determine their behavior, not the change in itself.
Yeah, there was a, I forget who it was that you had quoted about that, the something about the work of neighborhood change had more to do with like constructing a narrative than constructing housing.
That was I think the person I quoted, he passed sadly a few years ago, but it was a good friend and an amazing sort of community activist and neighborhood organizer named Mike Schubert in Chicago. And that was one of his key ideas about neighborhoods. And I think it's absolutely true. What is the neighborhood's narrative? What is your story?
Yeah, and like in that quote you shared in the context of the other things you're writing around that, like it helped some things kind of fall into place for me where I've felt resistance to some ideas for neighborhoods that like just on paper, I should be excited about, right? Because it, you know, whether it's like more affordability or higher quality public services or a nicer park or whatever, like I'm like, hey, you know, I should be excited about this, but I'm not because I think what helped me give language to is like they're not the planners of this are not considering the neighborhood narrative, the neighborhood history, the neighborhood story. I mean, just yesterday, actually, I was in a presentation about ADUs, accessory dwelling units, and there was one project that was done in a neighborhood here in Atlanta that was like 10 kind of ADUs were put on two single family lots. And like, again, if you just presented that to me on a screen with no other story around it, I'm like, this is awesome. Like, it's beautiful. It's well designed. It reduces car dependency. It increases density. Like all these benefits from it are right. But like, but once you take, you know, two dimensional plans and put them in a three dimensional neighborhood, like there were so much problems that evolved from all of that. And it wasn't just like NIMBYism. Like it was legitimate. Yeah. Like there were real concerns, like because there's people and there's relationships and there's a story happening here, which is to some, like I want to like talk some about gentrification. One of the things that you do that I appreciate is like, one, you deconstruct the myth that we've kind of developed around that. But what you keep in tension is it like, but it's also real because it's a real perception. It's a real pain that's attached to real trauma. So like, just because some of the data we think is there isn't there doesn't mean it's not real from a perception standpoint and a trauma standpoint. So let's unpack that a little bit. Talk to me about like, what is it we're getting wrong about? Because when we talk about neighborhood change, it's almost like we equate gentrification is like the only conversation we're having when we talk about neighborhood change. So like, help us understand what it is we're getting wrong about that dialogue that is so present in our cities right now.
Okay. First, there's so many different layers to that question. First, in terms of just the change itself, going back to neighborhoods change, constantly changing, is gentrification is not a phenomenon in and of itself. It is simply one of many ways in which neighborhoods can change. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if you look at a lot of cities and you look at how much gentrification is going on, and again, I'm talking in terms of you know, the classic planners thing, are upper income people moving in, are house prices going up, et cetera. If you look at how much gentrification is going on, and I've studied this in a lot of cities, and then you look at how much, how many neighborhoods are going in the opposite direction.
Yeah. Yeah.
There may be a lot more neighborhoods that are in some cities that are actually trending down, losing stability, losing their middle-class residents, losing their quality of life, seeing abandonment start popping up on blocks that until recently were healthily occupied, and so forth. And that may be as much or even more so than any gentrification going on. So it's important to put gentrification in context. Now, a lot of this depends on what the overall demand is. You've got to start, when you think about gentrification, you've got to start with looking at citywide and regional housing markets. If you've got a city where there are more people leaving than moving in, then you're likely to have more neighborhood decline than gentrification. If it's the opposite, then it shifts. You look at a place like Washington, D.C., you've got more gentrification than anything else. You look at Cleveland, not so. There, I would say in the entire city of Cleveland, there are maybe three or four Midland-sized neighborhoods that you could say objectively, these neighborhoods are gentrifying, and a lot more that are barely treading water, if that. So that's, I think, the first thing. So, and the fact is, you know, gentrification has its, believe it or not, positive side as well as negative side. Neighborhood decline, as far as I can tell, has no positive side. If you take a neighborhood, and I can give you hundreds of examples, say a black middle-income neighborhood that's been a healthy, stable neighborhood for decades and is now losing that because, you know, the generation of homeowners are dying off, the younger generation are moving to the suburbs, absentee investors are starting to buy up the houses, some of them are starting to become empty and so forth. That hurts. That phenomenon, which is incredibly widespread in most American cities, doesn't help anybody. So I think we have to look, you have to look at what's happening in neighborhoods holistically. And then when you zoom down to your own neighborhood, if it, I think one of the things that, you know, and sometimes people are very ambivalent about this. On the one hand, if you have a neighborhood which is disproportionately poor, that's a problem. Even if it's a relatively intact neighborhood in terms of not too many abandoned houses and so forth. I mean, people who are poor, there's one fundamental thing wrong with people, poor people. They don't have enough money. And if you don't have enough money, that makes it hard to maintain your property. If you're a tenant, it creates constant insecurity. You don't have the resources to support a shopping district. You don't, a neighborhood that is disproportionately poor is unlikely to be a healthy neighborhood, unfortunately. It's there are variations. I'm not saying it's hopeless, but a healthy neighborhood typically has some kind of an economic mix. So the
Go ahead.
No. So the issue to me is how to find the balance. And also how to minimize the type of displacement that can happen if you have, shall we say, too much gentrification.
I think that's a tension that we live in because we're like part of our model is like we're aiming for mixed income neighborhoods that we would push back against the concentration of affluence in the same way we would push back against the concentration of poverty. Right. That there's so many cascading impacts of a hyper segregation and concentration of poverty, right? Whether that's on the schools, public services, et cetera, there's just so many things that, that come from that. And so, but the tension we wade into is like the desire to preserve and protect historic culture of that neighborhood, which we're absolutely all for. And also the desire to see like, and the folks in that neighborhood deserve a healthy neighborhood. They deserve opportunity. They deserve beautiful things, right? And so like doing development and investment, but in a way that actually maintains and sustains what is there, but allows there to be a mix of uses, a mix of incomes, a mix of types of development that are coming. And for us, that's the, and I think when people come to our neighborhood and view our work, knowing that we do mixed income work, I mean, it makes sense when you hear a nonprofit doing affordable housing, but when we're doing both affordable and bank qualified housing, people are like, oh, but what about gentrification? We're like, absolutely, legitimate concern. But let's walk through like why it's really important to not just do a neighborhood full of affordable housing. Like, what are the problems of continuing to support America's segregation of low income people away from the rest of the city and cutting them off?
Exactly.
And to me, I'm like, I want us to keep talking about gentrification, but I'd love for us to do it in proportion to one of the bigger things that are happening is this constant segregation, concentration, and cutting off of certain neighborhoods from the city economy.
Yeah. And, but I think what you're talking about, you might call that the Holy Grail.
We are idealists over here after all.
Well, you gotta be. But, you know, again, when a neighborhood changes its income mix, its culture is going to change. Mm-hmm. I think one of the most important things, and people don't do this enough, is where a neighborhood is changing economically, where you are getting more of an economic mix, is to create some kind of process by which people can talk to each other, by which the longstanding residents can share what this neighborhood means to them with the newcomers, and the newcomers can absorb some of that. And so you can create, hopefully, a neighborhood that is economically diverse, but has a measure of cohesion and a measure of neighboring, rather than end up with what happens in some cases, is where you've basically got two camps, old timers and newcomers, and they're not communicating with each other or relating to each other. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is critically important because there is going to be some change.
Yeah.
You know, neighborhood culture can be a very fragile thing sometimes, and it may not last change. But the thing is, if you have a neighborhood that has a healthy neighborhood culture and that neighborhood starts to lose home ownerships and have, I mean, one thing that I find in a lot of neighborhoods, a lot of struggling neighborhoods, is that the people who are providing the neighborhood glue are all aging out.
Yeah. Yep.
And so if you have a generation of people who made that neighborhood culture, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they all pass. And they're not replaced by other people with the same commitment to the neighborhood and the same ties. The neighborhood culture is going to disappear regardless of gentrification.
Yeah, yeah. And that's the thing. We've talked about, like, again, I'm with you. The Holy Grail is such a good metaphor for this. Is that like pace and sequence, right? Like, how fast you do this and in what order you do this, right? It may have been Jane Jacobs that had the metaphor of like, neighborhood change is like slow irrigation, not like a flood of water to improve the drought, right? And so like at some level, there's a sense of like, this is why we start with neighboring, right? Like we start by the strengthening those weak ties and bridging those relationships that like, because again, so historic South Atlanta, that's a neighborhood where we are, like, it's at some level complex, but also really easy. Like we need some improvements in schools and infrastructure and housing. And like, we can go through the list and be like, yeah, this is super obvious. And like, and if we just had some billionaire saying, well, here you go, here's $100 million, fix all the problems. Like you would squash all of the asset and the beauty and the history and the story that's there. And in the day, like, yeah, it's a prettier place now, but It is a no place. It's an we unplaced it. It's not even a word, but you know, so there's a sense of like, how do you pace this? In what order do you do things? Like, and we don't start with a massive, you know, bank qualified housing development. It's like, no, can we stabilize the rental units that are there? Can we stabilize homeownership for the legacy residents that are there? And like, and as we kind of like build the strength of that, like the basic frame of neighborhood, how do we then begin adding the other parts to it? And I think there's something about like holding the urgency of how serious the challenges are with like, yeah, we didn't get here in a couple of years, and we ain't going to be out of this in a couple of years. And how do we really pace this in a way that's going to strengthen the neighborhood as it changes versus really erasure, you know, happening through that,
process? Which, going back to what we talked about a little while ago, is about, in a way, changing the story, creating a different, a more positive narrative for the future of neighborhoods. And convincing people, of course, because it doesn't matter if you have that narrative in your head. It matters if the people who live in that neighborhood have that narrative and feel, hey, this neighborhood is going in a positive direction. I want to be part of that.
Yeah, and that's something I'd really would want our place-based development audience to really be listening in on, is that yes to the development of systems and properties and buildings and institutions, yes, but if there's not also a cultivation or a development of narrative, of perception, of belonging in the midst of all of that, then we're not in the place-based development world. Actually, we're kind of in just the building development world.
Exactly.
Right? And like building and, places is a narrative work.
And I think one of the most, I think, a tremendously unfortunate thing about much of the community development field, right, is the extent to which, and a lot of this I think is driven by the need to pay the bills, that a lot of groups have gotten involved in basically development and aren't pursuing that, if you will, that slow, patient irrigation of the soil that is involved in building community and building a different narrative. Because if you plop down a 100-unit tax credit project in the middle of the neighborhood without doing that, all you've got is a 100-unit tax credit project, which becomes, it may be geographically in the neighborhood, but there's no impact there outside its walls.
Yeah, and I think that pushes us to like, at some level, if you're doing anything, you're a place-based practitioner, because you can't do any action if you're not in a place, right? We don't live in Plato's ideal realm. We're all in real context, right? But to like to authentically be in the field of place-based work means you have to consider the whole, right? And that you're not solving for housing, you're not solving for education, you're solving for neighborhood, right? That everything you're doing is in this like broad, kind of holistic, complicated type of environment.
Exactly. Because ultimately, you know, we've got to remember, it's about people. It's about people who have aspirations for themselves and their families and their children, and trying to create the process by which they can realize those aspirations. And if, you know, historically, and we're seeing this throughout this country, there's been an amazing, for example, amazing dynamic of Black suburbanization in the last couple of decades. Now, that's because those people wanted something for themselves and their families that the urban neighborhoods that they were living in were not providing them, and of course they had the means to be able to move to somewhere else. Now, I don't fault those people for one second.
Right.
They are making decisions in the interest of themselves, their families, and their children to have, whether it's more opportunity, a better quality of life, greater safety, whatever the specifics may be. I don't fault them. And if a neighborhood as a physical place does not meet those needs, then it's not, it's failing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's part of the really frustrating narrative cycle that happens is like we systemically have disinvested and harmed like Black and brown neighborhoods. And then as Black and brown families move out for more opportunity and the neighbor they left behind declines, then the blame gets, well, reason the neighborhood's bad is, I mean, y'all left your own people. Like, so we continue, like we start with the first harm of disinvesting and doing damage. And then we add a second layer of harm by blaming those who left for the decline that's there versus no. we're not going to put the blame of this on the people who have been enduring the systemic forces.
You can't blame, you know, blame doesn't do any good. It does. Mm-hmm. It just makes things worse. I mean, after all, after World War II, the same thing happened with thousands of white ethnic young mm-hmm. people, young mm-hmm. couples and families who left their historic ethnic neighborhoods mm-hmm. for the same reasons, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. to move, to have a better life, better place to live, better opportunity for their kids. And this is something that's, it's people want that.
Yeah.
You don't blame them. Now, the question is, what happens to the neighborhood then? But mm-hmm. you have to look at that as, again, and this is when you think about concentrated poverty neighborhoods, for example. Mm-hmm. In some respects, these are neighborhoods of people who've been left behind by what our society and economy offers in terms of mm-hmm. pathways to opportunity. Mm-hmm. Because, as I'm sure you know, the more money you have and the more opportunity you get, you can access. You don't have to be rich, but you have to be at least some level. Can you afford to buy a house? Can you afford to buy a house in a, say, a decent inner ring suburb and so mm-hmm. forth? So you have a huge part of the population that is basically left behind by our economy, by our society. And the question is, what of them? And that to me is, you know, a really critical issue. We can't not look at that. Mm. Just look the other way.
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, since 1970, you know, poverty rates have, with varying spikes and lulls, has declined in the United States. But what's increased significantly over that same period of time is the concentration of people who are living in low-income neighborhoods. So the overall, so we could look nationally like, oh, look, you know, poverty rates are going down, but what we see going up is how many people who are experiencing poverty are experiencing it not just as one individual, but they're experiencing it within an entire neighborhood of concentrated poverty. Why are we seeing concentrated poverty neighborhoods persist, increase? Like, what's going on? Is it just people with money are moving out, or are there other forces that are continue to concentrate poverty into certain neighborhoods?
Well, there are a few things. First, yes, people with money are moving out, which is part of a larger phenomenon. I mean, if you go back to 1970 or even earlier, you looked at most urban neighborhoods were economically mixed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just like in the pre-war period, when you had ethnic neighborhoods and Black ghettos and so forth, those neighborhoods tended to be economically mixed because people mm-hmm. formed neighborhoods around race, ethnicity, culture, and so forth, not around money.
Okay,
That is basically gone. Mm. I mean, you can find a pocket here or there, mm-hmm. but basically neighborhoods today are increasingly defined by how much money you have. How expensive a house can you afford? And as a result, and if you look at this, if you look at neighborhoods by median neighborhood income, there's been a drastic decline in the number of middle income, which tend to be mixed income neighborhoods in cities, and a dramatic increase in both wealthy neighborhoods and poor neighborhoods, which tend to be increasingly homogenous economically. And that's been a significant trend over the last many years. So that's a big part of it.
Mm-hmm. What would you say, like, what would be your, I mean, again, no holy grail, no magic bullet in this, but as we think to the next 50 years of neighborhood life in American society, what would you say are, I don't know if you're hopeful or you just kind of hope and wish for it, but so what do we do about this as we move forward? If we continue to see the middle neighborhood shrink, the affluence and low income continue to concentrate, like, what's to be done for a healthier future?
Oh, let me throw out a few things. I think in some respects, especially when we look at concentrated poverty neighborhoods, we've got to get back to basics. Mm. And when I say basics, saying, can we create neighborhoods? They don't have to be gorgeous. They don't have to be wonderful and so forth. But can we create neighborhoods that, regardless of the incomes of the people who live in them, meet certain basic human needs? Mm. And I'll say safety.
Yeah.
Decent access to jobs for the people who live there. Housing that doesn't have to be gorgeous, but is not unhealthy at a minimum. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He has enough heat, doesn't have mold, etc. And schools that their kids can go to and have a decent shot at opportunity for themselves when they grow up. Now, when I think about it, is that really too much to ask from an affluent country?
It should be the bare minimum, I would hope, right?
And the thing is, to a large extent, we know how to do all that stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, I'm not saying it's easy, mm-hmm. but, you know, there are people in this country, there are places in this country which take people who have the greatest disadvantages, people who are returning citizens from incarceration, people with limited educations, et cetera, and get them to the point where they can get and hold decent, well-paying jobs. We have schools in this country that are taking kids from the toughest environments and setting them up for success rather than failure. Now, we don't have a whole lot of either, mm-hmm. but we have enough to know that it can be done, that we can do it if we want to.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, part one. Mm. Let's start thinking about that, especially with respect to concentrated poverty areas. Mm. Number two, I think we have to try to protect our middle-income neighborhoods,
yeah.
including neighborhoods that were the center of middle-class Black life in America's cities, which in many cases are starting to lose their edge and starting to decline. And we have to, that's an area where I think rebuilding home ownership, for example, in those neighborhoods is a critical piece. And the problem, of course, is, you know, a young, I would say a representative, say middle-class Black family who has enough money to buy, not a mansion perhaps, but a house. And they look at, say, a lot of these neighborhoods, and they look at, they see that the area is starting to slip. They look at the houses that are come on the market and they start to say, oh my God, if I bought this house, I would be spending the next 5 years in a construction site and I don't want that for my kids. Mm-hmm. And so you have a whole series, they ask questions about the schools, they look at, you know, all kinds of things, but they end up not buying. We have to make, I think in many respects, one of the most fundamental things is to make middle neighborhoods attractive places for young people to buy. Hmm. Another thing I think we should be thinking about at the same time, and this is especially true in terms of if you're trying to build housing, is if I had my druthers, I wouldn't like to see another tax credit project built in a concentrated poverty neighborhood.
No, yes, yeah.
I would like to see them built out in the middle-class suburbs in locations, preferably locations that have decent transit access and where you can walk to shopping, but if not, not. And start to create more opportunity for low-income families in the those parts of this region that offer opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think this is, again, this is doable. This is a becomes a question of state policy. It becomes a question of zoning law. There are a lot of issues. But I know in New Jersey, where I live, some years ago, the State Housing Finance Agency changed its ground rules and pretty much said, we want to projects in areas of opportunity, growth areas.
Yeah.
And, well, you know something? Developers said, we can do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And fortunately, we have a, you know, state laws that require all municipalities to accommodate their what's called their fair share of low and moderate income housing, which means that getting entree into affluent suburban municipalities for affordable housing in New Jersey isn't as tough as it might be in some other states.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The fact is this is doable. So I think those are probably what I would think of as a big three. Focus on restoring the basics to concentrated poverty neighborhoods and then build from there. Focus, stabilize and save the middle neighborhoods, especially the predominantly Black middle neighborhoods, and increase access to opportunity for low-income people.
Well, thank you for this. It can be done. I think that's the piece where like, and it's not just an idealism of the nonprofit professional, but that we've, there are examples where it is being done and it can be done. And it may be bad news that we've designed our places to work so poorly. But the good news is if we can build it one way, we can build it another, right? We can, it doesn't have to be this way. It's not naturally like this. Like we can craft another way. And I'm thankful to you for investing your life, your passion, your gifts, your scholarship, and calling us for a better way. I've benefited from it. My team is benefiting from it. And I know our listeners will as well. So just thank you so much for the work you're doing and for being a part of this conversation today.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
If this conversation has piqued your interest, I would encourage you to pick up The Changing American Neighborhood, The Meaning of Place in the 21st Century, wherever books are sold. Place Matters is produced by Focused Community Strategies, whose mission it is to partner with under-resourced neighborhoods to provide innovative and holistic development that produces flourishing communities and God's shalom. Place Matters is hosted by FCS's training and consulting team. If you would like to inquire about our training and consulting services, please reach out to us via our website or find us on LinkedIn and social media. This information can be found in the show notes. If you would like to watch these episodes, the videos can be found on our YouTube channel. And if you like this episode, please share it on social media. Your support means a lot to us. The show was edited by Tim Rhodes with music by Eric North. Special thanks to David Park, Becca Klein, and Rose Silva at FCS for their work in organizing and recording these sessions. We would like to say thanks to our partner, Lilly Endowment, Inc., whose Thriving Congregations grant has made this podcast possible.